Never blame a mountain for what it does. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast leaving decisions to the pilot's discretion. Looking back, we can see that 1980 was the year that the disaster movie boom of the 1970s finally ended. During that decade, films like The Towering Inferno and The Poseidon Adventure had enjoyed huge box office success. However, by the end of the 70s, it was clear that the genre had run out of steam and that the public were losing interest. Then, in 1980, disaster struck the disaster movie. In that year, cinemagoers were treated to the razor-sharp genre spoof Airplane, which lampooned the clichés that had become all too familiar to audiences. And in the wake of that film's success, studio bosses declared the disaster movie dead. All of which makes the film we're reviewing here very interesting. Released in that fateful year of 1980, it was one of the last disaster movies to be made as part of that classic 70s phase of filmmaking. So, on this show, we're reviewing High Ice. To help me look at the film, I'm joined by the biggest fan I know of the disaster movie genre. It's the master of disaster himself. It's Fred Anderson from Schmollywood Babylon. Welcome back to the show, Fred.
Thank you. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your fabulous podcast. And I'm always ready to talk about exploding helicopters and, you know, actors cashing paychecks. You know, I love it. I do love it. You know me. I really love it. You know, it's
well, I'm glad we can combine our two passions, mine for exploding helicopters and yours for disaster movies. And people may remember your last appearance on the podcast when we reviewed the volcano themed disaster movie When Time Ran Out. And, you kind of spoke a bit about your passion for disaster movies then. So I just wondered if, perhaps you could sort of remind listeners, you know, what is it about these films that you love so much?
I'll keep it, I could talk for hours about this. So, I'm going to keep it short. This is how it started. I was thinking about this. In some old Swedish movie encyclopedia, I saw a still from Mark Robson's Earthquake. A still, a quite wide shot, and you saw how buildings were crumbling down. And I love miniatures. I love, small things, And I was like, really, I have to see this movie. And thankfully, a classmate of mine, who could have been like 10 or 11, stole a videotape from her father and sold it to me for, at the time, probably quite a lot of money. And on that tape was Earthquake. And I watched it and, I fell in love because Earthquake is, I'm not kidding you, I consider Earthquake probably one of the 10 best movies ever made. I do. It's a masterpiece, And but there's a lot with the, especially in the old movies, where you see the miniature work, you see the attention to detail. Not always, but there's something with it. And I remember when I got my first Lego set, and it was an airport, and the only thing I did was crashing the airplane into the airport, because it's like a miniature. You can create your own disaster. I built a volcano in papier-mâché once with a small city around it and blew it up. That's me.
Yeah. Wow, interesting insights into your psyche there, Fred, and your need to destroy, humanity and its structures. But you obviously Earthquake is a very special disaster movie for you. But I kicking myself for not asking you this question the last time you were on. What is your favorite disaster movie?
Well, outside Earthquake, let's skip Earthquake for now because I'm always talking about that. I know people won't agree with me, but Meteor, the one with Sean Connery and a bunch of other bored actors. I honestly think it's from 79. It's at the end of the disaster movie cycle. And I think it's like a perfect disaster movie. Kind on the cheap, in some parts, some stock footage and stuff, but it is a good movie. It's never boring.
Well, I know that's an important quality for you. The idea of things being good or bad, it's for you. It's more about, is it interesting or is it boring? And that's the kind of the definition of like a good or a bad movie for you.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if it entertains me, it's perfectly fine, you know. And I've said that about a lot of movies that people usually don't consider to be masterpieces or good movies or great movies. But you know, I just don't want to be bored. You know, I really don't want to be bored. That's it.
Now, there's one thing I wanted to address before we kind of got stuck into this particular film. And, you know, because I've built High Ice up in my introduction as a disaster film, and there might be some people out there who perhaps would consider it more of a, I don't know, fight for survival film or a man versus nature. You know, perhaps the scale of this film is too small. So before we sort of got into reviewing High Ice, I wanted to get your view on whether we should consider High Ice a disaster movie or not.
Well, I would say we can consider it a disaster movie. It's kind of it's merging, you know, adventure, survival, with disaster. It's kind of just, I mean, it has a lower budget, so they just focuses on one part of the story. I mean, you'll find this story in this movie. You'll find in basically all disaster movies, you know, a smaller group of people trying to survive somewhere. And in the bigger budget movie, it cuts away to Charlton Heston doing something silly or Sean Connery looking bored or whatever, you know. But this is kind of, in a way, the essence of a disaster movie. I mean, the thing that why people are watching disaster movies, they want to see people survive and maybe die. So I would say, yeah, absolutely. If you count movies like Fire or Flood or Hanging by a Thread, disaster movies, this is definitely a disaster movie.
Well, I would agree with you, Fred. I think in terms of like the story it's telling, the kind of style of it, the sort of structure, and also when it came out, I think it's definitely part for me, definitely part of that 70s era of disaster movies. So I'm certainly happy to include it, but I'm also happy that an authority on the subject, such as yourself, agrees with me. So.
Oh, you.
Okay, I think it's time to get stuck into High Ice. So let's see if Trailer Man can tell us exactly how cold it is.
Below freezing and beyond fear, North America's last great wilderness, White Horse Mountain, the ultimate challenge for every climber who dares. Suddenly, the memory of love is all they have to hold on to. A dream in the midst of a nightmare. The towering adventure filmed on a killer mountain.
Avalanche! Run! Run back to the snow cave! Run! 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 God! God! Help me!
Hell frozen over in a petrified world where only the strongest can survive.
God!
David Jensen as the chief ranger who had always ruled the mountain.
If you can't pull him off that mountain, I'm going to get him some supplies.
Take position.
Tony Musante, as the search and rescue expert determined to take command.
Then you'd better take a radio with you, so I'll know where to look when we have to save your neck, too.
All the daring of man pitted against all the power of nature.
We're going to try a hoist extraction.
Get away! Get away! Get away!
Go back. He's lost his mind.
Get away!
How long do you think you'd last up there without the proper equipment?
I'm not a damned fool.
What the hell does that mean?
Tell her to jump!
Jump! Jump! Jump to my head!
I can't reach her! She's down on the skid! She's too weak to climb up!
An incredible story reflecting real people, true events, and the kind of courage you'll find only in High Ice.
A grizzled park ranger and an arrogant army lieutenant attempt to save a group of teenaged rock climbers stranded on a mountain ledge. Naturally, the two men are incapable of working together and clash as to how best to carry out a rescue. Meanwhile, on the mountain, frictions emerge amongst the four stranded climbers as they try to stay alive long enough to be rescued. High Ice was released in 1980. It was made as a TV movie and was broadcast as an NBC Movie of the Week. in the early part of that year. However, after its broadcast in the States, this film was released theatrically overseas. The cast is headed up by David Janssen. Now, he was a huge star of American television and is best known for playing the fugitive in that iconic 60s TV series. Sadly, the film was one of his last roles, as a month after it was broadcast, Janssen died of a heart attack at the age of 48. Also in the cast, we have a very young Dorian Harewood and Tony Musante, who you may not know the name, but you'll definitely know the face. He's a great character actor with a huge amount of credits. You might have seen him in things like Pope of Greenwich Village or the fantastic prison drama Oz. This was directed by Eugene S. Jones, who also came up with the story alongside his wife. And the film has a 6.2 user rating on IMDb. So, Fred, with all of that out of the way, what did you make of High Ice?
First of all, we all know that David Janssen died, you know, like a month after this was released. And I know you mentioned it to me, and I was like looking at him in the movie and said, well, you know, he looks like a pretty healthy, you know, 75-year-old man, you know, there's no, you know, I was like, I didn't understand what's the big deal. And then he was 48 years old. He was 48.
I know, it's quite incredible when you look at him in this film, because he doesn't look like a well man at all. I mean, he's got loads of grey in his hair and his beard, and his skin just has that. It's a well known fact that David Janssen was a massive. I mean, he was like a 60 a day cigarette smoker. He was also a massive boozer, but I think his skin just has that quality of somebody who's just drinks alcohol and smokes and probably can't remember when he last had a solid food.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, he is a good actor, and I really like him in this movie. And okay, I will back a little bit here, because first of all, I've seen a lot of made for television movies and made for television disaster movies, and I must say that this one looks pretty good. I mean, for being what it is, it has a, you know, cinematic feeling. It looks more expensive than it really was, I would say. I'm impressed by it from a technical point of view.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, because the mountain climb, or the scenes set on the mountain, actually look like they were filmed up a mountain. So I don't know, you know, whether that is through the magic of camera work, that they kind of create the illusion that, you know, these people are actually up quite a, you know, at quite an altitude, or whether they actually, you know, were at a reasonable height and, you know, they're kind of using some experienced climbers to kind of get those shots in the bag. But it definitely, you know, you see some sort of TV movies and, you know, the kind of the stuff on the mountain, sort of it's really obvious this is in a studio. And but there's quite a lot of camera work here where you think, well, they must be out on location, and you kind of admire that in a made for TV movie that they've found a way of making it look as good as it does.
Yeah, it's an impressive technical achievement for this kind of movie. I mean, of course, we have the close-up shots of the people, you know, on the mountainside. That is studio. But then you have these, you know, shots from above or more wider shot, where, I mean, it's obviously people on a mountain. They couldn't fake that in the studio. And even so, the helicopter scenes and the whole, you know, the mountain itself, it's an impressive production. I read somewhere that it had like a budget of $2 million, which I guess is still a pretty okay budget for the time for a TV movie. But I mean, compared to some of Irving Allen's movies, which I like a lot, this one looks like a, you know, I almost said $1 million, but it's $2 million, of course, or three. it also had something that I always appreciate in disaster movie. It had a powerful score. Mm. The music in it feels like it's taken from a 70s disaster movie, you know, with strings, and you know, it has that slightly melancholic "we're all gonna die" feeling, you know, and still romantic, you know, Hollywood style. The thing is, I mean, when you mentioned this movie to me, I hadn't seen it. To my surprise, of course.
Well, yes, because so you've generally seen everything that's ever been made, haven't you?
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you so much for leading me to this little pearl, this unpolished diamond of disaster cinema. I really understand why it got some kind of cinema release in other parts of the world, because it's worth it, you know. I would love to see a better version of it, though, you know, like on Blu-ray or even DVD.
Now, when we spoke about disaster movies, when we were talking about When Time Ran Out, I remember from there, you said there were kind of like three elements to those films that you enjoyed. You liked seeing old movie stars being killed in disturbing ways. You liked miniature work, and you liked beautiful melodrama. Now, it's fair to say that High Ice is pretty light on movie star deaths and miniature work, but it does have a lot of melodrama. So while they're stuck on the mountain, these teenagers, amongst them, some previously unacknowledged tensions between the group come to the fore. What did you make of this group and the issues that they were dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, Scott, the character of Scott, he's the token disaster movie asshole, the guy who, you know, really make things even worse, you know. I mean, as we all know, and that's the reason why we talk about this movie. And it kind of still, you know, there's a lot of screaming and crying, and you know, Scott is kind of like, you know, old man yelling at birds. You know, he stands there and screams at the helicopters. I honestly think that he's my favorite characters of that trio up on the mountain. I mean, he's like, is it Richard Chamberlain in Towering Inferno?
Yes.
You know, this greedy asshole who gets burns alive. He's kind of like Richard, but maybe a little bit more innocent. I mean, he's clearly the weakest character. I mean, the girls, they handle it a lot better than him, which kind of feels refreshing also.
Yes, I mean, he is... I couldn't put it better than yourself. He is the asshole of this movie. He's this quite cocky, arrogant character. He's also a massive bully as well. he's kind of, you know, he's got this. He's gone on this climbing expedition with his girlfriend Kathy and this other couple, Liz and Tom. And it's quite clear that Kathy is not that interested in mountain climbing, but she's only sort of going along with this because it's one of Scott's passions. But you know, rather than try to, I don't know, help her along or coach her in mountain climbing, he's just basically yelling at her for her incompetence, which I just love the the simplicity of the relationships. And I guess that obviously it sets up establishes the kind of the pretext, I guess, for his behavior later in the film, where when they find themselves stranded in this nightmare situation, stuck up this mountain, he goes a bit mad with hypothermia, and he also gets kind of some burn injuries as well from when the helicopter blows up. And he's basically responsible for the deaths of the pilots who are in this helicopter that tries to rescue them. And I kind of like the fact that there is at no point does he have a kind of moment of self-reflection and sort of think, you know, I've behaved really badly here. I've killed people. I mean, he's also the, when they do, like, they try another rescue and they start pulling these people off the mountains, he's the first one into the helicopter. There's no...
Yes. I was watching that scene for like 3 or 4 times, because I wanted to really understand that he's the first one on the helicopter. You know, I was confused, you know, because I was according to the storytelling in disaster movie, he would die also. Mm. You know, he would, and now I'm spoiling here, but please correct me if I'm wrong, but he doesn't die. He's on the helicopter and he's saved. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. It completely goes against what you like understand or the conventions of the kind of disaster movie genre, because yeah, he's behaved in such an appalling way, sort of, disaster movie like justice demands that he be killed off. But he's not. He's the first to be saved.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not kidding you. I had to check so he didn't fall off the helicopter in the start of that scene. Yeah, I was like, what? Mm. So yeah, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Looking at, it's unexpected, but it's still also a little bit disappointing because, you know, the disaster needs a sacrifice of some kind, one of the leading characters, which, will happen later, of course. But, you know, Scott, the good-looking asshole.
Yes, tremendously enjoyable character in this film. And there was another aspect to the kind of the melodrama that we get on the mountain, which just adds to Scott's like douchebag qualities, which was that he's on this mountain expedition with his girlfriend Kathy, but it's clear that Scott, I think he's quite clearly he fancies Liz, who is this this other girl that is on the mountain expedition with him, and we get a tremendous scene between Liz and Kathy where Kathy is basically blaming this whole mountain climbing disaster on Liz and the fact that she was kind of flirting with Scott and kind of trying to challenge him to climb up this mountain.
Oh, you know, there's always room for some melodrama. There's always room for some puny. Is that the word? Puny? Something small and silly that they will probably, you know, these were probably best friends. Now they, you know, everything is destroyed. This trio of young friends will be unhappy basically for the rest of the 80s if they don't die of some cocaine overdose or something. I don't know what they did in the 80s. But
Well, we had all of that melodrama taking place on the mountain, but we also get some more of it off the mountain. So we have David Janssen as this veteran mountain ranger who's been involved in countless rescue missions, and he's clashing with Tony Musante's sort of inexperienced by the book army captain who's in charge of the rescue, and he isn't keen on taking advice from a civilian like David Janssen. What did you make of that side of the melodrama equation?
Well, I you know, this is one of the more interesting things with it, because in a way it kind of seems like Musante, a great actor, by the way. I love him in Bird with Crystal Plumage, the Dario Argento movie. He kind of, in a tragic way, goes out as the winner in this movie, because David Janssen, our 48-year-old, 100-year-old person, dies quite tragically at the end. And you have this clash in between them. And I don't know, maybe I'm bitter and old, but I kind of understand Tony Musante here. I'm kind of on his side. You know, I know we're supposed to root for this old fart, but Musante, he's a pro. He might not have as much experience as Janssen, but, you know, he wants to do good. And, he have some good ideas that, unfortunately, I can't, you know what I mean, doesn't really work out because of Scott. I don't know what to say, really. I don't want to sound like an asshole, you know, for being on Musante's side here. I kind of wish they did a little bit more of it, you know. I mean, I understand it's a TV movie and they have, like, what is it, like 90 minutes. I would have loved to see more with them fighting this out, not physically fighting this out, but I would like to see it go more in depth there. Maybe I'm just rambling here now, but that's my first thought about their relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of inclined to agree with you, because, you know, if I mean, one of the reasons that the first rescue mission goes completely wrong and the rescue helicopter ends up blowing up is because the pilots are not obeying Tony Musante. So, you know, that tragedy, obviously Scott plays a big hand in making it happen. But part of that tragedy is, as you say, Tony Musante was right. If they, you know, they had followed his instructions, that disaster would never have happened.
Yeah, absolutely. But I know. But we're supposed to root for Janssen. I understand that, you know. But if I can skip to another character, which is also a archetype, you would say almost a Jungian archetype in disaster movie, is the little annoying boy. Here's the grandchild of Janssen. I really would like to, you know, bring that character up a little bit because he have this annoying nose. All American boys at the time had this little nose that goes slightly upward like a little pig. And he have this blonde, almost reddish hair. And okay, he doesn't do much, but he's around. He's you know, people will adore him, the viewers of the movie. But I'm even if he's not, I mean, I would almost expect him to be in some kind of danger during the movie, but he's not really. He's kind of on the side. But I appreciate that this kind of character is there to just annoy me, because that's part of the fun with disaster movies. You must agree with me. There's always an annoying boy and sometimes an annoying girl in this movie.
Oh yeah, there's always an annoying child who will risk any number of people's safety by doing something really, really stupid in what's clearly an emergency situation where we should just be obeying adults.
Like in The Swarm.
Yes.
Remember those kids there who go and, you know, they go and provokes the bees?
And bring about disaster for that poor family. So yeah, they are a staple. But actually, that's an interesting Janssen's grandson is interesting, because we also meet David Janssen's daughter in this film, and that's a kind of element of melodrama that doesn't really go anywhere in the film. So we meet Janssen, who's his daughter is a divorcee. She's living in his home with her young son. And at the beginning of the film, she announces that she's going to be moving away. She's got a job and she wants to sort of like pick up her life again after her divorce and separation. And Janssen's wife is dead, so he's just going to be in this house all alone. And it sort of sets something up there, which doesn't actually go anywhere in the film, like, which, I mean, perhaps there are reasons for it, but later on, in the sense of, as we've already said, David Janssen gets killed off, so like, what does it matter if she moves away or not? But it's like they hadn't really kind of thought through that idea properly in the script.
Yeah, I totally agree, because it's definitely a setup for something larger, something bigger. It's almost like something, you know, they rewrote the script towards the end or something, you know, before the you know, but I have no idea how they would get her up and the kid up on the mountain, you know, to end up in danger. I have no idea about that. But it feels like something is missing there, because she just wanders around looking kind of worried. And the boy with his nose is doing the same thing. And, you know, and then Janssen dies. And I have a theory about his death, by the way, but we can go to that later. Something's amiss, as they say. And it's kind of, you know, I would love her to just go up with the helicopter because he wants to see her one last time, or, you know, and something happened. But no. To be honest, maybe I was kind of a bit unfocused in the beginning of the movie, because first I saw her as his awfully younger girlfriend, and I was like, no, I mean there's always that, you always have, you know, huge age differences in movies, but so it took me a while to understand that it was his daughter. Actually, I did. I just want to say that.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the ending of this film, the dramatic conclusion to the action that we've seen here. So David Janssen, in his efforts to lead the rescue of the climbers, has fallen down the mountain and become wedged in a crack. and he can't get out. I mean, he's injured, he's in pain, but he heroically slings a line across the mountain to enable Kathy, who's the last climber up on this mountain, slings that across and helps enable her to be winched off the mountain. Unfortunately, the helicopter can't stay any longer, so it flies off, leaving Jansen to freeze to death on this mountain. Now, I'd love to know what you thought about this ending, Fred. I mean, for me, it's one of the most undignified deaths I've ever seen in a disaster movie.
Yes. I you read my mind here. This is probably the worst death ever in a disaster movie. I mean, I always bring up Charlton Heston in Earthquake. You know, he saves 100 people and then he gets flushed away together with Ava Gardner. You know, his young trophy wife, by the way, which she's older than him, I think. Anyway, you know, there you have something. You have here a probably a very, very drunk David Jansen is put in some kind of, it looks like a hole. You know, he lands there and he kind of sits there with his arms. It's like he's getting sucked up by the mountain like a cocoon or something. I don't know what's going on there. Probably, you know, to keep him upright. And he sits there, and then it's a cold night, and then he's dead. That's it. This is, and then you cut to the helicopter pilots, and you see them, you know, they talk how they're going to take his body, and then you cut to this frozen David Jansen hanging under the helicopter it's a very, very silly doll hanging under, you know, like he's like cartoon stiff. No, yeah, it's not the best. I mean, I can understand that he died, you know, but also kind of belongs in the genre, but it's very undramatic. Yes. You don't feel anything.
I completely agree, Fred. I mean, I couldn't believe that they decided to have the very last shot of the movie to be David Jansen's frozen corpse just dangling from the end of a rope on a helicopter. I mean, he's meant to be sort of the hero. You're meant to sort of feel something that, okay, you know, he gave, you know, and as he does, he gives his life in order to save that girl, and his reward is to see his frozen carcass.
Yeah, it's hilarious, actually. It's tragic and hilarious. I felt that something is missing. Mm. It felt like there was something more. Usually it would be a nice tension-filled scene where they lift him up, you know, with details, and maybe he's half alive and we don't know if he's dead or alive or whatever. But everything like that is kind of rushed mm. over, you know. You don't see anything, you don't feel anything, there's nothing. And I wonder if Jansen was too drunk or too ill towards the end, so they just kind of they sold the whole finale mm. like this, just to, okay, let's not bring him to set today. Let's, you know, let him sleep it over in the motorhome or something. Yeah, in the trailer. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we all love David Jansen, but obviously it was a fact he wasn't really super healthy. You know,
I think there's possibly a grain of truth to that, Fred, because it is such a peculiarly staged ending that, you wonder if something went on behind the scenes that meant that they just thought, you know what, we can cut something together out of what we've already filmed.
Yes, but to be fair, he didn't seem that drunk. I mean, in the scenes he shot. He's probably a quite experienced alcoholic. I mean, have you seen The Last Dinosaur with Richard Boone?
I have not. John Hart?
No. I mean, Richard is obviously drunk as an egg through that whole movie, and it's very, very visible. You know, he's like me. He can't speak clearly, so it's like blah, 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 blah. And they try desperately to cut scenes together with him talking and moving. And you don't see that with Jansen here, except the end where, you know, mm. he kind of just disappears. So, I mean, respect to that. You know, I don't want to you know, I don't want to bash Janssen because I like him, but he served the movie well up until then.
Yeah, even though he looks very unwell, very unhealthy in this film, you can still see that he's still got that like power and intensity as an actor. He's still bringing something, you know, even through his brutal hangover, he's still bringing something to the movie. But one thing I was thinking when I was watching, because I do think this is one of the most undignified deaths I've ever seen in a disaster movie. I don't know how well you remember The Towering Inferno, because it brought to mind, you know, Jennifer Jones' death in that movie. Jennifer Jones, you know, big star in the 40s and 50s. Retired from acting in the mid 50s, and The Towering Inferno was like the first film she'd done in like 20 years. And she basically, in that film, she falls out of a lift to the, you know, that's on the outside of the skyscraper. And again, that it's just, she just falls out the lift and like no one reacts to that moment. She's dead now. We've got too much else to do. We've got to crack on with the plot.
Yeah, out with her. Just get rid of her. Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of those. Makes me think about, I think it's like Richard Chamberlain in The Swarm, where he gets attacked by bees and he waves around and he falls towards some kind of, what do you say in English? Some
console.
Kind of... Yeah, console, and everything blows up. That's a good one also. And you have those poor bastards inside the elevator in Earthquake. You know, it's a quite dramatic scene, but then you have the blood splash, the animated blood splash towards the end of it, which kind of brings it down a notch when it comes to dignified deaths. Yeah.
Okay, I think we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about the exploding helicopter action.
A motion picture event. Earthquake in Sensorang. Your most startling motion picture experience. Earthquake. You feel it as well as see it in Sensorang. You will experience every sensation, feel every realistic effect of an actual earthquake. Starring Charlton Heston, Ava Gardner, George Kennedy, Lorne Greene, Genevieve Bujold, Richard Roundtree, plus the city of Los Angeles and its millions of people. Earthquake. You feel it as well as see it in Sensorang, rated PG.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs fairly early in the film. The army are called in to try and airlift the teenagers off the mountain with a helicopter. However, in order to winch the group up, the helicopter has to fly dangerously close to the side of the mountain. As the chopper hovers above, it's buffeted by high winds and is prevented from maneuvering to safety. It's also prevented from maneuvering to safety by the stressed out Chris, who is clinging on to the winch, even in the face of, you know, everyone yelling at him to let go. The inevitable happens and the helicopter ends up crashing into the rock face and exploding. Fred, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
This is a scene I like a lot, actually. You know, I like the intensity of Scott. You know, he's climbing onto this, what is it, like a ladder or rope or something, and he's screaming and yelling. And it is a very effective scene, I think, even with some overacting from the actor's side. And it also have a refreshing angle because, correct me if I'm wrong here, the helicopter crashes above them. Which makes things fall down, which, you know, something you see very rarely in movies, that you have parts of you're under a helicopter that explodes and crashes. Do you agree with me there? But because I see that very, very seldom.
That is quite unusual. You don't normally see people being directly underneath the helicopter that they're being exploded in, although there is a very good example of that in a film called, to go off on a little bit of a tangent, Countdown in Esmeralda's Bay, where George Kennedy uses a rifle to shoot the pilot of a helicopter that is attacking him, and the helicopter then explodes, and then George Kennedy is instantly killed by some of the wreckage that falls on top of him. And
it's a fantastic scene. It's a
so yeah, there are a couple of examples of it, but it's surprisingly unusual.
Yeah, and it's what I also appreciate here, that there is some pretty good, what I understand, pretty good miniature work being used here with the helicopters. The version I saw of the movie was a bit blurry. You know, it was some VHS rip. You know, but it looked good. I think it looked like it looked. I'm not going to say it looked realistic, but it looked good.
Yeah, I was actually really impressed by the exploding helicopter in this film, because I think it's actually much better than I was probably expecting as I was watching the film. So as you say, it's a really well staged scene. Really enjoy the way Scott is like freaking out, and you know, you kind of feel the tension of like, are they gonna be able to get out of this situation before disaster strikes? But then the execution of the exploding helicopter is fantastic. The kind of the shots that they have of the flaming fuselage kind of dropping down the side of the mountains are really good. I mean, the fuselage is like a absolute furnace of flames. And I don't know quite how they staged that, but it's really, really well done, as you see it drop quite a considerable distance. Fantastic scene.
You're a poet. I need to say that. I've never heard anyone talk so with so much poetry and passion in their voice about burning helicopters and helicopter parts. For I mean, I'm serious. It's like listen to, I don't know. It sounds great. I want to give you that credit. Can you say so? I don't know. Now I'm just rambling because I'm so impressed when you're talking about helicopter explosions. It is a very impressive sequence. It is. It's ambitious. It feels like they actually spent some time doing the special effects works in this movie, which only that sequence is more impressive than most of the disaster scenes in, for example, Irvin Allen's TV disaster movies, which feels quite, you know, choppy and made quickly and with some stock footage, and this one looks great. This is a very, very nice helicopter explosion, helicopter crash. This is one of the finer in made for television movies.
Yeah, I think it's could definitely be up there in the kind of the best of list of those. I wanted to kind of throw in a bit of trivia here, Fred, which I was doing my research for this, and a lady called Michelle Green had left a user review of this film on IMDb, and in that, she basically says that she lived in Darrington, sort of near Washington, where this film was made. And apparently, she lived a few houses down from where the helicopter was, the kind of like the wreckage of the helicopter was that was blown up in this film.
Oh. So
you can imagine how exciting living near the wreckage of an exploding helicopter that had been in a film would be for me, Fred.
Yeah, absolutely. I envy her, really. I mean, it's so nice of you also to bring up these comments on IMDb, because I mean, the comments on IMDb is a cesspool, except when there's someone who lived near a film location, the location for one of these movies, or, you know, my uncle actually is visible in the background, and then, you know, I love it. That's the best part of the IMDb comments. And this one, I didn't notice this comment, but I really have to. I found it. Yeah. I live in the small town when they made this movie. The name of the blah, blah, blah. They filmed the mountain scenes in our high school gym. I met all the actors. It was great. It's awesome. Really cool. Michelle Green. Yeah.
I might try and track her down, see if she's still living in the area, see if she can see if that helicopter's still there, and whether she can send me a photo of what it looks like today. If I have a spare half hour, I might do some investigation work on that front. But we've spoken about David Janssen. I think we're both enjoy his acting, even when he's quite clearly the worse for wear due to massive vodka consumption. But he's worth mentioning in this part of the podcast because he's actually been in a surprising number of films with exploding helicopters. So he was in John Wayne Vietnam movie The Green Berets, which has an exploding helicopter in, and he's then also in a couple of other TV movies that also have exploding helicopters in. So he was in a trucker movie called Hijack, and then he was also in the helicopter TV movie classic Birds of Prey, which is all about which basically sort of two helicopters chasing each other for 80 minutes, and there's an exploding helicopter in that as well. So I mean, David Janssen, a sort of unlikely figure to have been in quite so many films with exploding helicopters, I feel.
Well, maybe it was in his contract, you know. There's this macho thing with exploding helicopters, you know, and Janssen was a macho actor, a sensitive macho actor, of course. But, you know, I can see him read the script, you know, oh, it's a young mistress. Oh, that's great. Some booze. Yeah. Oh, helicopter. Yes. Not that accent was, of course, totally wrong, but you get my point there.
I think you captured the essence of David Janssen perfectly there, Fred. So
can I bring up another actor which I like a lot in this movie? An early part of an actor called Dorian Harewood.
Yeah, go for it. What do you want to say about him?
Well, we all know that he's in one of the best Die Hard ripoffs ever, Sudden Death. With Jean-Claude Van Damme, he plays the good guy that is real to be a bad guy towards the end. He's the assistant of Powers Booth, and there's a exploding helicopter in that one too, I guess.
But there are two exploding helicopters in that film, and the one at the end though is one of the greatest of all time in my view.
You see, you know, and it's as soon as I saw him, I felt, okay, this is a good movie. You know, this is something special. This guy's he knows his helicopter movies, really. So I was very happy to see him. And the girl who played Liz, Gretchen Corbett, I've never heard about her before, so I won't pretend that. She was also in the Nicolas Cage movie Pig. Quite recently, which is one of the finer Nicolas Cage movies out there. So I was, you know, I have a soft spot for veteran actors and actresses who get some kind of second career, you know, in later years doing quality work. So super happy to see her also.
Okay, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Fred, thank you so much for joining me once again. Would you like to take a moment to tell people where they can find you online and to plug any of the stuff that you're up to?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You can find me on Twitter as at Homo Satanis. I'm usually in a quite good mood nowadays, so you can follow me there, and I follow back if you're nice. On Instagram, you can follow me on Shmollywood Babylon, where I post mostly, basically only movies, the movies I watch, and my huge collection of Blu-rays and DVDs. I would say that's the best way to get to know me. That's about it. I have a Swedish podcast, actually, Märkliga Faktorn, which is it's about high strangeness and the paranormal, but it's in Swedish, so most of you won't even understand what I'm saying there. So that's it, I guess.
Thanks a lot, Fred. As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website, where you can find reviews, facts and stats about films where helicopters explode. If you can help spread the word about what we do by rating, reviewing or retweeting, then we'd be very grateful. We'll be back soon. But until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters. We'll be right back.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Rescue 3, this is 1. Got a weather update. Put McDonald on.
Rescue 3, stand by. Go ahead.
Come on, Patrick.
McDonald, you're going to have heavier winds than were predicted up on the plateau, and there's a new system moving in. Do you still want to go on?
You drop us off, we'll get the job done.
Hawkins, if it gets too rough up there, I want you to wave off. Say again.
Wave off, understand? Over.
Yes, sir. I understand it as pilot discretion, sir.